I gotta tell you, I haven't had that much approval in quite a while. It was back in the day, people were yelling that loud to get rid of me. My name is Chris, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Chris.
The grace of God separated me from alcohol somewhere around December 28th, 1989. Willingness born of desperation moved me into these rooms, and I started to do some of the things that you people taught me. That enabled me to do at least a moderate job on the maintenance of my spiritual condition, and I am very, very grateful to have been sober all of this time. My talk tonight is going to be on AA history, but before I get started, I want to qualify this a little bit. Knowing a little bit about history, I love reading history, and I love studying different kinds of historians in different kinds of historical contexts. History is a weird thing. It's not like you can go back in time with a VCR camera and get it right. What you can do is you can put together all the bits and pieces of the data that are still recorded and try to put together the best perception you have from the material available. And each historian is going to have a different twist, usually, on what happened and what their theories are. So I take no responsibility in accuracy in this talk. It's certainly my own perspective. I've read a lot of history on Alcoholics Anonymous, especially the non-conference approved. Okay, because that's just the kind of guy I am. You know, the conference stuff is like, you know, is like vanilla. You know, I like a little bit of craziness. So I went outside the box a little bit in some of my studies, as that'll probably be apparent. Anyway, Alcoholics Anonymous. We all know it basically started with Bill and Bob. But what was going on? It's important to understand what was going on in context during that period of time to really understand where they came up with what they came up with. All throughout history, recorded history, alcoholics have been around. Ever since man crushed grapes, alcoholics have been around. And for the most part, except in very, very brief periods of time, most alcoholics would die drunk. The real alcoholics would just drink themselves to death. There was rarely anything that could be done. There was a couple of brief periods of time. The Washingtonians were around in the mid-1800s. There were a bunch of guys who were drinking in a Baltimore bar this one time, and they said, you know, we ought to sign that temperance pledge. What was happening in the 1800s is they were running around with temperance pledges, and you'd sign this thing saying, you know, I'm going to be temperate or I'm going to be abstinent. I'm not going to drink. Not the most popular document that probably that you bump into and somebody asking you to sign in a bar. But that's what happened with these guys. And they said, you know, we're getting in a lot of trouble with this booze stuff. Why don't we go ahead and sign this? And you know what? Let's make a pact with each other. You know, we'll all help each other, you know, keep abstinent. And that's how the Washingtonians started, a handful of guys from Brooklyn. And they got involved in some of the things that Alcoholics Anonymous does today. They got involved in fellowship. You know, they'd meet together. They got involved in speaking. They got involved in finding other alcoholics to try to bring into the club. And for a while, Washingtonians stayed sober. It's estimated that over 300,000 members of Washington in the Washingtonians who were at least members, if not sober alcoholics, and that happened in a period of less than 5 years. So they had really much better success, I think, than Alcoholics Anonymous in the first early years. What happened though with the Washingtonians is they got involved in some other things. They started to half of them wanted to abolish alcohol, the legality of alcohol altogether. They wanted it to become illegal. Some of them said, no, I don't think alcohol should be illegal. We just can't drink it. So there was a split there. Some of them got involved in the abolition of slavery. You know, there were some big social issues that were going on. And when you have 300,000 people, you know, that's some clout. So, and also, people started to speak for the Washingtonians. In other words, you know, somebody who's a big blowhard ego would get up there and, you know, he would say, "We Washingtonians!" And, you know, he would start speaking for the Washingtonians, and that would piss off a bunch of other ones. And it ended up that within about 5 years, the Washingtonians went from six people to 300,000 back down to almost zero. And most of the people who were alcoholic in the Washingtonians died drunk because all of a sudden they didn't have any action to participate in. Now from say 1870 or so on, until really, the early 1900s, there was also a period of time where there really wasn't much for the alcoholic. But all of a sudden, some of these early organizations, started to pop up. They were basically evangelical religious or organizations. There was the Jacobi Club. There was the Emmanuel movement. There was the Oxford Group. And the Oxford Group is significant in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous because that's where Bill and Bob got sober. You know, you don't see a lot of emphasis on the Oxford Group in the conference approved literature, a little bit. But it was enormous, the influence of the Oxford Group. There was no AA meetings in New York until somewhere around 1937 or 38, and there was no AA meetings in Ohio until almost 1940. What there were Oxford Group meetings, the drunk squad of the Oxford Group. Now, what was the Oxford Group? This man named Frank Buchman, who was a minister, one day he was running this organization for boys. It was almost like a YMCA kind of a thing out in Pennsylvania. And he had some ideas about how this thing should be run. And what happened was the board of directors got together and outvoted him on a bunch of stuff, saying, you know, "Frank, this isn't really the way we want this whole thing to go. We've voted, and this is the way it's going to be." And he quit in a resentment. Anybody in here ever get resentments and quit?
Yeah.
I got to tell you, I did that about 15 times. There was one time I got really drunk, went into a blackout, called up my boss, threatened his life, said I was going to kill him, and then because it was a blackout, I forgot, and I went into work the next day. You know, like nothing was going on. So, I understand the resentments, you know, much to his consternation. Anyway, so he quits, you know, "The hell with you guys!" And he goes to England. And in England, he's going to church this one day, and he hears this woman preach, and it blew him away. It was one of those spiritual moments where it just, all the information just hits you right at the right time in the right way. And what happened was he had a big change of heart, and he decided that what he needed to do was he needed to get back to the Christian principles that the Christians were practicing in the first century. There was a lot of really good stuff going on in the first century of Christianity, a lot of unbelievable faith-based stuff. So what he did was he started to pull out of the Bible, he started to pull spiritual principles, actual spiritual exercises out of the Bible. And this helped him to form this group. It didn't have a name until the press gave it a name one time when he was giving a big talk in Oxford, England. They called it the Oxford Group. So what happened was this spread. You know, there was no TV back then. You know, there wasn't a lot to do. So a lot of these social things were really big. And the Oxford Group grew very, very quickly, and it was basically, it had these characteristics. They would have weekend get-togethers. They would have what they were called house meetings, where you'd get everybody you can to somebody's house, and the whole weekend you would be doing spiritual stuff, much like, you know, the workshops and the retreats that we do in AA today. They also practiced surrender. They practiced confession, which is kind of like our fourth and fifth step. They practiced dependence upon God. They practiced restitution, which is like, you know, trying to make up for the stuff in your past. And then they practiced witnessing, which is, you know, we do that in our 12 steps. So a lot of the basics of the steps were inherent in the Oxford Group process. Bill and Bob both end up in the Oxford Group. And Bill gets sober almost right away after a couple of embarrassing moments where he was really drunk and pushed the speaker aside to like babble incoherently, you know. That's something we don't see as much anymore in AA, but, Dr. Bob basically didn't get sober. He was in the Oxford Group for 3 or 4 years and never got sober. Now, why? What's the difference between what they did? I believe that sobriety and recovery are very, very contingent on how busy you get. What kind of a sense of urgency do you bring to this deal? How much participation are you going to be putting into it? Are you just going to come in and sit in the back and hang out, get a cup of coffee and complain about everything and then get the hell out of there as soon as you can? Or are you going to get busy, especially with this group? Are you going to suit up and show up and grab the commitments take advice from sponsors and stuff like that? What are you going to do? Now, the difference between Bill and Bob was Bill got very, very active. He started finding alcoholics and dragging them to the Oxford Group. It really caused a lot of concern in the Oxford Group. The Oxford Group finally kind of threw him out in 37 or 38. You know, there's a letter of apology in our archives from Sam Shoemaker saying, you know, Bill, we just didn't realize the importance of what you were doing. But he was bringing all these drunks into the religious fellowship. But he was busy. I mean, you know, he was trying to practice the principles. He was trying to make restitution. He was doing the things that he was being asked to do. And he stayed sober. He stayed sober long enough, thank God, to start putting together the mechanics of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, Dr. Bob, on the other hand, is out in Akron, and he's going very begrudgingly. You know, he doesn't really want to be hanging with those people. And he would come late, and he would leave early, and he never said anything, and he didn't get involved. And he didn't get drunk. He didn't get sober. He got drunk. That's a lesson that we can really look at today. But they get together. They get together finally. And they form the type of bond that was formed in the Washingtonians. Let's stick together. Let's try to stay sober together. And let's try to help other alcoholics to get sober. One of the most significant things, I think, and especially in our literature, is in Bill's story, where he says, I laid there on the bed in the town's hospital, and I realized that there must be millions of alcoholics out there dying every day. You know, and he basically dedicated the rest of his life to helping those alcoholics. He was still detoxing on the bed at that time. Now I am incredibly grateful for that particular demonstration from Bill Wilson, because I believe I'm alive today because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was quick on the way to checking out in the late 80s. I wouldn't have been able to drink much longer. But these guys get together, and Bill is typical alcoholic. He meets Bob, and he moves in, you know, and he wires his wife and says, honey, I found this new friend. I'll be back in a couple of months, you know. And he, like, moves in with Dr. Bob, and they set to work, you know, curing alcoholics. Dr. Bob was a doctor. More accurately, he was a proctologist. Okay, and he was a proctologist who wasn't doing really well with his business because everyone knew him as a drunk. Okay, so he was running out of proctors to work on. You know what I mean? Like there was a joke that would go around the hospital where he worked that, you know, if you go to Dr. Bob, you could lose your ass. And you know, that was a very literal interpretation of what could happen. You know, so he was running out of patients, so he had some extra time. You know, so he made some deals with the hospital staff saying, you know, we think we have a cure for alcoholism. What we want to do is, you know, we want to start admitting some people. And that's what they did. They went about the business of admitting people. And there was no real qualification process. You know, I think we've really learned today where we can kind of see willingness in people and where we can't, and who to spend time with and who we're wasting time with. they just tried everybody in the early days, and they started the period of flying blind, which is they were really learning what worked and what didn't work. And they were paying attention. You know, if they were doing it right, the people were staying sober. If the people were doing it right, they were staying sober. And so a group started to form around the Akron area. Bill finally had to go home, and he got another group started in New York. And it's also very, very significant to look at what was going on in New York and what was going on in Akron. Bill kind of strayed away from the I don't want to use the term evangelical because it's not really right, but there was a real enthusiasm about working with others in the program of recovery that continued in Akron. And what happened was when that was brought to New York, there was kind of a sense of, you know, you're trying to shove religion down our throat, you know, all this God stuff. And the difference between those two groups is no one stayed sober permanently in New York under Bill Wilson's care, not until the book was printed. And a lot of people were staying sober in Akron. Well, why was that? What's the difference? The difference is because the principles of the Oxford group were being not only encouraged, they were being required if you wanted to be part of this drunk squad coming out of the Oxford group. If you wanted to hang with Dr. Bob and the boys, you needed to do some things. You needed to pray. You needed to do your confession. You needed to have an attitude of defeat. You also needed to make restitution, and you needed to start working with other people. Now, we all know that that's really working a program in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's how you maintain your spiritual condition. And that places you in the sunlight of the Spirit where God can keep you safe and protected from the next drink. Now, I don't know that they knew that, but that's what they were doing. Now, in New York, because there were so many atheists and so many people that were psychological and everybody had a hard time with it, I mean, they still do in New York. If you go to New York City meetings, you'll know exactly what I mean. You can't force any knowledge on anybody there. You know what I mean? They've got their own thing. And so there was really, really poor recovery in New York. However, the thing that Bill was doing was he was a visionary. He was a very, very far-seeing man. He started almost immediately on putting together the traditions. He started to look at what would benefit this society as a whole. He was a big picture guy. Dr. Bob was get in the trenches, work with an alcoholic one-on-one every single day. You know, and these two people really, really worked well together. I don't think anybody would have stayed sober without Dr. Bob. And I don't think AA would have grown outside of Akron if it wasn't for Bill Wilson. So we needed these two people. Now, Alcoholics Anonymous starts to grow. And what really helped them was some media exposure. There was a number of articles that were written in newspapers. This one guy, Jack Alexander, he was basically somebody who would go in and find out the truth about something. And he was like, he did exposés. He would go in, he would find the corruption in the Longshoremen's Union or whatever. I mean, he was known for this. And for one reason or another, he was pointed in the direction of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he spent some significant time with some of the different groups in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when he wrote his article, he said, these guys are for real. They really don't want your munch. They really do just want to help other alcoholics get to stay sober. So when that article went out, there was a Liberty Magazine article. There was a number of other articles that went out. Our membership grew in leaps and bounds with this media exposure. So somewhere around the late 1940s, we're really doing well. I got to tell you, your chances of staying sober, walking into Alcoholics Anonymous in the 40s, meaning business. In other words, okay, I'm here. Tell me what to do. I'll get busy. Your chances of staying sober were huge back then. They really were. where people have studied the archives from the different groups, and there was membership lists with sober days. People have interpreted that there was at least a 50% recovery rate, if not much, much higher in these early groups. Now, I got to tell you, there was a Grapevine magazine. I was looking for it here because I saw some grapevines. It was, I think it was the January or February Grapevine. And they brought back the gray pages, the scientific pages, which is, I think, a cool thing. In that article, there was an independent agency that did statistical studies on 12-step groups, not just AA, but 12-step groups in general. And they went around and they did a lot of interviewing, a lot of auditing. And what they came up with is they came up with this percentage. 45% of the people who attended a 12-step meeting were sober less than a month. 45% of the people who went to a 12-step meeting were sober less than a month. Now, this was an independent agency. It wasn't AA, but AA backs it up by publishing it in the Grapevine. So I'm not going to tell you our statistics suck, okay? Alcoholics Anonymous is telling you that. Now, in the 1940s, you had a better than 50% chance. Now you have a 45% chance of staying sober a month and a 55% chance of not. You know what I mean? That's what this article is saying. I want to talk a little bit about some of the changes since 1950 or so. I think there's a number of causal reasons why our recovery rates have changed, because I think the fellowship has changed. The fellowship has changed a huge amount. I think that there is a couple of reasons why the impact. First of all, when those articles were put out, let's say you guys were a home group of 50 people, and the article goes out in the Liberty magazine or the Jackie Alexander Saturday Evening Post article, all of a sudden, imagine 15,000 people showing up at this meeting. Just like tomorrow. I mean, what are you going to do? That's literally what happened to them back there. Not 15,000, but in corresponding numbers. They had brand new newcomers who were taking people through the steps. Brand new people that were working with other people. Oh, you're sober a day? You can help Harry. I mean, you know, they had to do that because so many people came in. Now, I think that kind of changed the dynamic a little bit. And, I'm not saying for good or for bad. I just think it changed the dynamic a little bit. But one of the very, very significant things that happened in Alcoholics Anonymous was Bill Wilson had finally put together what he believed was the final draft of the traditions. These are traditions that have helped to keep Alcoholics Anonymous together. He understood intuitively what the alcoholics would do to destroy themselves from within. Our egos would destroy. There would be fighting over everything. And the, I don't know about you, but I've been to some home groups. I had a home group, I never mention the name because I don't want to give Myersville a bad name. But I had this home group, okay? I had this home group. And did I just do what I thought? And what happened was there was like 100 people there on Tuesday night. Tuesday night was home group meeting. And then there was a Friday night meeting. And there was 100 people there strong. And what happened is group consciences started to happen. You know, somebody would say, I want to have a group conscience. I'm wondering where my money's going. And one petty problem after another started happening. And every single week there was like somebody having a group conscience because they're pissed off about something. And what happened was the group went from 100 people down to about 4. And almost had to close, literally. And, you know, that's what the alcoholic ego will do. You know, we'll blow ourselves up. So Bill tried to protect us with these traditions. And I think it was a good thing to do. Absolutely. What happened though is Bill knew that no one was going to buy the book with those traditions. I'll prove it with this. Everybody, honestly, everybody in here who has a copy of the 12 concepts for world service on their bookshelf and reads it, please raise your hand. Okay. I'm seeing zero. And because this meeting is recorded, I want to say zero out of 450 people. Okay? I mean, think about that. If there was a book on the traditions, none of us would buy it. Bill knew that. You know, if it was like how to help yourself, it would fly off the shelf. But if it's like how to help your group, I ain't got time for that. You know. So what he did, I have this non-conference approved literature. It's called The Soul of Sponsorship. And what it is it's actual copies of the letters between Bill Wilson and Father Ed Dowling. Ed Dowling was a Catholic priest who became one of Bill Wilson's spiritual advisors in the 40s. And in this letter, he's basically saying to Father Ed, you know, I've got the traditions nailed, and what I'm going to do to sell them is, we've put together 12 essays on the steps. It's going to make the book fly off the wall. We're using that as bait. You know, so that's what happened with the 12 and 12. Did we really need the essays on the 12 steps? That's really debatable. Are they great essays? They're great essays. I don't think there's literature on this planet that pins the alcoholic personality down harder than those essays on the steps. When I read it, I go, oh my God, how did he know? You know, I'm a horse's patoot. How did he know this? You know? But he knew he was unbelievably intuitive about the alcoholic personality. But here's what happened. This is what AA looked like in the 30s and 40s. You get together one time a week. It was read tonight in the tradition. You get together with all the people one night a week, and you talk about, you know, what's going on that week. Who are you working with? What kind of steps are you doing? Where are we going? Okay, you're getting current with your people. Okay, that's Monday night, say. Tuesday night, you're out at the hospitals searching for drunks to work with. Wednesday night, you know, you're out at the insane asylums trying to find drunks. Friday night, you're down in the Bowery cruising Skid Row trying to find some drunks. Now, by the weekend, you've found some, and you have them in one of the hospitals that was working with us. And you've got him in the bed because they used to hospitalize you. Even if you didn't need it, they wanted you in a hospital bed to try to show you how sick you are. Because alcoholism is an illness of complete minimization. All right? We're always 20 times sicker than we think we are. So let's put him in a hospital bed, okay? And then they would parade the home group members past the people, one after the other, telling their story. Go tell their story. Go. So that's what you're doing on the weekend. And then back Monday, you're back hooking up with everybody, talking about what was going on, who you made contact with, who are you helping. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous looked like in the early days. It wasn't one closed-minded discussion meeting after another. It was like getting out there in the trenches. Now, something that happened in the 40s when we really started to expand and the meetings started to get bigger is there had to be things called like beginner's meetings. And a beginner's meeting, you were basically the program of recovery, the 12 steps, was explained to you. I see this going on every single time I come through this group. There are people over in the corner taking other people through the steps or explaining the program of recovery. You know, this is a group that gets that. But there's a lot of groups today that don't get that. This is a group that does. So you're explaining the program of recovery. And then there were speaker meetings. There were people who would, you know, get up and tell their story. What it was like. What happened. What it's like now. You know, I was a total unbelievable drunk. You know, I got hooked up with these AA people. I went through the steps. I had a spiritual awakening. Now I help other people. And my quality of life is out the roof. This is what they would do in the 40s. What happened when the 12 and 12 was written? What did we start to do? Anybody in here been to step meetings? I mean, I got to tell you, when I first got sober in 1989, I was going to 4 step meetings a week. You could not shake a stick without hitting a step meeting. Now, you know, I got to tell you, the essays in the 12 and 12 are not, they're basically not instructional. They're more like philosophical. They're more like experiential. They're not, they're really not the program of recovery. That was put in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. So what happened was it made much more sense to have step meetings instead of big book or beginner or speaker meetings. It was just more fun. Everybody would get to share. And they started to do these step meetings. So it just made sense. There's 12 steps. You know, there's 12 weeks and 3 months. There's, you can get through the book 4 times a year. It makes mathematical sense. So all of a sudden, step meetings are all over the place. Now, is that a bad thing? It's not necessarily a bad thing. One of the things that Bill Wilson used to share a lot was the good can sometimes be the enemy of the best. You know, is the step book bad? No, it's a good book. It might even be a great book. But the book Alcoholics Anonymous is where the recovery program is found. So the step book became the enemy of the big book. Just because it took, so many of us took our eyes off the ball. When I got sober in 89, there was one big book meeting, and it was about 15 miles away from my house. We're talking about 200 meetings, you know, within 20 miles of me. There was one big book meeting, and what they would do is they would read a paragraph and share, and they could share anything they want, and they would read the stories. Now, if you've ever seen this book, the program of recovery is like this, and the stories are like this. I mean, you could be on the stories for a year and a half that way. Now, somebody dropped the ball. Okay, because all of a sudden we're not paying attention to the recovery process in Alcoholics Anonymous. What we're doing is we're fellowshipping and we're sharing and we're doing discussion meetings and we're doing step meetings. I think we did a lot of that to ourselves. But there's another intervening factor which I believe is very relevant too. In 1956, the American Medical Society declared alcoholism and drug addiction a disease. Now, who cares about that, really? Well, it slowly made it incumbent upon insurance companies to treat for it. Okay? Now the insurance companies, well, if you're suffering from a disease because you're getting really drunk, you know, that's an illness, that's a medical illness, the insurance company should pay. So that's what started to happen. I don't know if anybody else in here got sober in the 80s or early 90s, but you could not shake a stick and not hit a treatment center. There was 4 of them within walking distance of my house. And very few of these treatment centers had a clue how to treat alcoholism. They were using crazy therapeutic techniques. I'll give you a friend. Here's one of them. Group. Anybody in here ever do group? In your outpatient or whatever, where there's one counselor sitting there just waiting to go home, you know what I mean? And there's a whole circle of people, and you're just sharing like, oh my God, my day is just so terrible, you wouldn't believe how bad my day was, oh God! And then, you know, shut up, will you? I want to share. Oh my, you think your day's bad, my day was terrible, oh! And you go around a group, you go around a circle like this. Now, Who figured this is a treatment for alcoholism? This is some kind of crazy psycho thing for people with other trying to treat alcoholism with group. You're going to a gunfight with a penknife. You know what I'm saying? You are. I'm telling you. Listen, I was exposed to group till I wanted to follow people out into the parking lot and kill them. You know, they took too much of my time. I wanted to share. Now, this was not helping my uncles, but they didn't know what else to do because I'll tell you what, the treatment center that I went to was really well respected. There are statistics out there today that show it almost doesn't matter what kind of therapeutic a treatment center uses. It almost doesn't matter. As long as there's a really strong counselor-client relationship. If a counselor really connects with you and spends time with you and guides you and mentors you, kind of like a sponsor would, you've got a better chance of staying sober when you leave the treatment center. The statistics are in. Okay? They know what works in treatment centers. The rest of it is window dressing. Now, guess how many hours I had with my counselor in this really, really highly respected treatment center. I didn't have one one-on-one. You know what I had? Group. Like 6 times a day. Because you only need to pay the one counselor for 20 people. If they were giving you a lot of one-on-one counseling, it would have doubled or tripled the overhead. So what happened when all these treatment centers that didn't know what they were doing were being funded unlimitedly by insurance companies? Where were the people going when they were leaving the treatment centers? They're going to AA, right? What do you think they expected to find when they got there?
Group.
That's right. Let's form a circle and go around the room. You know, that's an instance where we were kind of inundated and we weren't really able to manage that. Or the old timers dropped the ball, or, you know, however you want to look at it. But I believe those are very significant events that have happened, that have moved us to the type of fellowship that have 45% of the people under 30 days. Now think about this. This is really how big the problem is. Let's say there's 450 people here today. Okay? Let's say 10 newcomers come in every single week and raise their hand and say they're new. That wouldn't be unusual in a group that big. You know the group doesn't really grow. It kind of stays the same size year after year after year. This group grows a little bit because it's a good group. But most groups kind of stay the same size. Yet they have newcomers coming in all the time. What does that mean? That means the same amount of people that are coming in are leaving. Where are they going? I truly believe that a lot of people show up in Alcoholics Anonymous who are not really alcoholic. They're in because they got in trouble, or, you know, a well-meaning friend. You know, there's a percentage of people that come in and figure out they're not alcoholic and they go away. And that's fine. But you can't tell me every single person that comes in is one of those. Why aren't they staying? I think what was going on in the early days was because you were encouraged and even required to engage in a recovery program and to get busy working with others, you couldn't just sit home. You had to get in the car with the boys and go to the asylum. You know, you had to participate, or they really didn't want to bother with you. With that kind of participation, that increases your odds of being able to participate in the maintenance of your spiritual condition enough to stay in the sunlight of the Spirit, where God can keep you safe and protected. If you don't participate, you don't even know how much you need to participate, because there's no signs that pop up in front of you and say, if you don't get to 2 more meetings or work with somebody this week, you're going to get drunk. You know, there's no road signs that we see, so it can happen suddenly. But what happened was, when the emphasis was taken off of the things that worked, the things that really worked, and put on other things, like group and whatever, what happened is our statistics started to go down. And that would be okay, except for the fact that a lot of us die when we go back out drinking, you know? So I think it's very, very important. This is a group, Burnsville's group. There's a number of groups around that I believe are participating in the renaissance. It's basically a renaissance that's going on within AA. Getting back to the basics. Getting back to the things that really work. The things that can really get you to a place of recovery. And not an untenable sobriety. Actual recovery. And we're starting to pay attention again. Where did this start? Where did this start? Because we had gone so wrong by the 60s, 70s. AA was pathetic in the 60s and 70s. I don't care what anybody says. I've looked at it. I've studied it. The one thing that actually was the saving grace, I think, of Alcoholics Anonymous were two guys named Joe and Charlie. In 1978, they decided to do a big, well, they'd been studying the big book, studying it like this. Okay, it says these things. How about if we actually do what it says to do? Nobody's done this in 20 years. Let's see what will actually happen. And they started to really work the steps as they were laid out in the book. And they started to go to conventions and give talks. So there'd be a backroom big book study, you know, and the rest of the meetings would be about resentments or something. But there was like a little big book study. And, you know, somebody went in there and taped it. This is the story. Somebody went in there and taped Joe and Charlie doing like a 4-hour big book study. Was blown away by what he heard, made multiple copies of this tape set, and at the next convention during the banquet, strategically gave those tapes away as prizes on the table, strategically to people in different areas of the country. So every single state, somebody in every single state got a Joe and Charlie set of tapes for a prize at the banquet. Now, all of a sudden, boom, here we go. Big book studies, you know. Joe and Charlie, they start touring around, you know, they're in the limos and the Learjets now, you know. You know, they got the women, you know. They really started to get big. I believe this started the Renaissance to get us back to the mechanics of recovery. You know, there's many, many people who've come since Joe and Charlie and completely kicked Joe and Charlie's ass as far as, you know, laying out a program of recovery. There's Hawk in Houston, Scott Lee, there's a whole bunch of people who are just really, really good. And they only got their shot, I believe, because of what Joe and Charlie did. Joe and Charlie started the whole thing. Now, we're in the middle of a renaissance right now. I see it as this. I see it as incredibly important because here's what I believe. I believe there's a scale of alcoholism, okay? It talks about it in the book. Read the chapter to wives, you know, drinker number 1, 2, 3, and 4. It talks about it in the doctor's opinion. Some of the places where Bill Wilson talks about it is no matter how far down the scale you have gone, okay? That's a hint right there. We've all heard that 100 times. But there's also a sentence in More About Alcoholism that states, one's ability to quit on a non-spiritual basis will depend on how much control they've lost in drink. So there's people, some are sicker than others, okay? I used to hear the most crap when I first started coming around to AA. Oh, being an alcoholic's like being pregnant. You can't be a little bit pregnant. Well, you can be a little bit, you can be a heavy drinker, you can be alcohol dependent, you can be a flat out crazed alcoholic. There's a scale. Now, the issue is the people who've gone down the scale and are what this book on page 20 describes as real alcoholics are not going to get or stay sober doing group. They need a vital, transformational experience. It has got to be a God consciousness coming over you. And the only way I have seen that happen is going through the steps and having the spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. Now, why is this important? It's real important if you're a real alcoholic. It may not be so important if you're a heavy drinker. What I see that happened in Alcoholics Anonymous since say 1950 is Alcoholics Anonymous actually became a dangerous place for a real alcoholic to find recovery, because there were so many half-measure groups, there were so many half-measure sponsors, there were so many people who didn't understand what needed to happen for the spiritual awakening to take place. Just keep coming. How many of us have seen people that just keep coming and never get sober? Just keep coming doesn't work. Well, just don't pick up the first drink. It says in here 100 times you can't do that, and if you can, you're not an alcoholic. So, you know, what's happened is it's become a very, very dangerous place for alcoholics to find some kind of recovery. What happens is the heavy drinkers and the moderate drinkers do fine. They form sober softball leagues and they get on with their life. But the alcoholics are dying, you know. This fellowship was designed for those same alcoholics that can today die because they're in half-measure groups. That's why I believe the renaissance that's going on today with getting back to the basics. Look, I'm not one of these guys that say, well, you know, you didn't do a six-column fear inventory, you did a five, you heathen, you know. I mean, you know, there's a lot of latitude with working these steps. You're never going to do them perfect. You're never going to finish them. But what you need to do is you need to participate in them if you're really in trouble. Now, the thing is there's so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous today that don't know they're not really alcoholic. It's not their experience. And they see somebody coming in and out doing exactly what they're doing, and they're still drinking. And they're like, you know, you're just not honest with you know, you don't want it. Let me tell you, by the time I started walking through the doors of AA, I wanted it. You think I wanted to go down into a church basement and talk about God during primetime TV? You know what I mean? No way. I really wanted it, but I couldn't stay sober until I got really busy with some stuff. Yet I came in with a bunch of people who joined the Sober Softball League and went to one meeting a week, never got a sponsor, never helped another person in their life, never did a commitment, and they stayed sober. What's the difference there? The difference is there's different levels of intensity, and it's not how much you drank, it's not how much trouble you got in. The scale, the barometer is how much choice have you lost in drink? How much choice have you lost in drink? You know, the people that have never left the house, you know, they've been housewives and never caused any trouble can be horrible alcoholics. People that have had 14 DWIs can be heavy drinkers. You can't look at the externals. You've got to look at the relationship with alcohol. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love this group. You guys are absolutely awesome. You know, if I tried this kind of a talk at some groups, I'd have two guys lifting me on each elbow out the door. But you guys are cool. Thanks a lot for having me today.